Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. This is Philip Lance, your host for today's interview with authors Noreen Gifney and Eve Watson about their book, Clinical Encounters in Sexuality, Psychoanalytic Practice and Queer Theory, published in 2017 by Punctum Books. By the way, I usually say welcome to the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast, but this time I'm keeping it indefinite because this interview may find its way onto other New Books channels, such as the New Books in Gender Studies and New Books in Critical Theory. This is an interdisciplinary book edited by Noreen and Eve, with a host of fantastic contributors from the fields of psychoanalysis, culture studies, and queer theory. Noreen Gifney works as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist in private practice, and she is a lecturer in counseling at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland. She has published a lot of books and journal articles on psychoanalysis, gender, sexuality, and cultural studies. Eve Watson is also a psychoanalytic practitioner working in Dublin, Ireland, and she teaches in the graduate programs at Dublin universities. She trained in the Lacanian psychoanalytic tradition, and her areas of publication and special interest include theories of sexuality and gender, critical theory, film, and cultural studies. So welcome to the program, Eve and Noreen.
Thanks very much, Philip. And just to say, on behalf of Eve and myself, we're really grateful for the invitation to have a conversation with you today. And as someone who has been listening to the New Books in Psychoanalysis series for years, I was personally very excited to receive your invitation. I drive a lot for work and I listen to the podcasts, and I really like the engagements that you have with the authors. They really enliven the book for me. So I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you very much. I'm excited about presenting this to our listeners, many of whom probably really have never thought about this subject or may not know much at all about queer theory or what in the heck it has to do with psychoanalysis. So I think it'll be really something new and stimulating for our listeners. And I want to, before I'm just a few questions down the line, I'm going to ask you, what is queer theory for people who just are beginning with the basics? But why don't we begin? Let's see. By the way, where are you two? Are you in Dublin or other parts of Ireland?
Philip, this is Eve. I'm in Dublin. I'm speaking to you from Dublin today.
And I'm speaking to you today from Donegal, which is in the north of Ireland. And then I work in Northern Ireland, which is across the border between the north and south of Ireland.
Oh, wow. That is so cool that we can have these cross-Atlantic conversations so easily nowadays. Okay, well, let's begin by hearing about how this book came to be. And what was your objective? Why did you want to create this particular book?
Thank you, Philip, so much for the opportunity to speak about clinical encounters in sexuality. This is, a question that pertains to our desire. What did we want to do in putting these two discourses together, psychoanalysis and specifically clinical psychoanalysis and queer theory? This had not been done before. And And what we also wanted to do was to put a multiplicity of psychoanalytic schools together as well. So this was our project. Maybe I could tell you a little bit about how this began and how this came into being, yeah. if that would be okay.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. So this all began in 2009. So this has been an 8-year clinical psychoanalytic project. And it began in 2009 when Noreen approached me with an idea. And you could say this was our first encounter. And the idea that she came to me with was, why not put together for the first time two discourses in a series of discursive encounters, the two discourses being queer theory and clinical psychoanalysis, in a collection that we would edit. And I've always been interested in interdisciplinarity, and this was a new idea of Noreen's to put these two discourses, who are, let's say, well acquainted on a theoretical level, to put them together in a sustained engagement around the question of clinical practice. And since my university days, I've been very interested in queer theory. I was actually introduced to queer theory as an undergraduate. So Noreen and I collaborated. I said yes. And it's been very fruitful. And this also comes out of my own interest in interdisciplinarity, which I think fits well within the Freudian, Lacanian tradition, out of which I did my training. You, as I'm sure you know, Freud was a devoted and wide reader of philosophy and literature and anthropology, religion, and more, and indeed Lacan was as well.
Okay, I want to just interrupt and say, so the first time that we're bringing really together queer theory and clinical psychoanalysis, I guess that's an important distinction, because I think then you also said that queer theory and sort of, I don't know, academic psychoanalysis, those two are there's familiar. That's been a realm that's been explored before, I guess, in books and journals. But is there a distinction here between the clinical and, can you say more about that?
Yes, sexuality studies, gay and lesbian studies, sexuality studies, and queer theory has drawn from psychoanalysis for many years now, and has done so theoretically. What we wanted to do was to add in this clinical component. And indeed, there are different ways of thinking about that, as I think emerges in the book. So this would add in that dimension, which is one of the distinguishing dimensions of psychoanalysis. It is a praxis. It is both theory and practice. And we wanted to introduce that in to see what that encounter would produce. And would it produce something new? Would it allow us to ask new questions? Would it allow us to come up with different answers, etc.? So this was very much from its inception, a project that didn't have a guarantee in terms of what it was going to do. It was designed, and I think Noreen is going to speak a little bit more about that, to be a series of encounters, the outcome of which we would not know until indeed the book was finished.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, I read your afterword, Eve, today. I just finished it this morning, and it was really nice. It brought a lot sort of together for me. I think some people would have put it at the beginning of the book, but let's talk about how the book is put together. It's got a kind of a distinctive structure or way it's put together with different sections. And so I guess Eve is going to, Noreen is going to tell us about that.
Yeah. As Eve said, this book has come out of an 8-year clinical psychoanalytic and interdisciplinary research project. And just further maybe to what Eve has just said there a moment ago about how the book came into being, I suppose one of the things that I noticed when I became involved in clinical psychoanalysis, I had worked in gender and sexuality for years, was how clinicians who worked psychoanalytically could be so curious and thoughtful about the minutiae of psychic life, the smallest things. But that when it came to sexuality, there tended to be a reification and all curiosity seemed to fall away. And that wasn't true of everybody, but it was true of quite a number of clinicians. And I suppose I was interested to see what we could do with this book in order to, I suppose, unhinge some of those sticking points and to open up that reification to thinking. So in order to do that, I suppose we organize the book in a particular way, as you say, that's not always usual. The book includes 30 chapters by 32 invited contributors, and these include academic theorists working in gender and sexuality studies, but also practitioners of psychoanalysis from a number of different psychoanalytic traditions, so Freudian, Kleinian, Lacanian, independent, relational, Jungian, and so on. And the book uses then queer theory. The book is an encounter between queer theory and psychoanalysis, but it's also an encounter between a variety of different psychoanalytic traditions about sexuality. And it uses queer theory as an interlocutor for those various different traditions to come together, because queer theory is, and we'll get into this a bit more as we talk, but queer theory is at the forefront of theoretical discussions about sexuality. But it's also a discourse that is wary, very wary, of psychoanalysis as a clinical practice because of the history of psychoanalysis and how it's treated LGBT people, and also as a discourse. So we used a number of structuring devices in the book. First of all, it's structured around a series of questions that we pose and that occur in my introduction for the reader literally. So there are four questions that we ask the reader to keep in mind as the reader reads. The book is also arranged in a series of three sections, each of which facilitates the reader engaging in a series of encounters with a variety of different discourses and ultimately with their own views about sexuality. And the book is also framed by an introduction by myself and an afterword by Eve, which both function as the facilitating environment. They frame the book, but they function as a facilitating environment for the reader's interaction with the text. And as you said, it might be usual for an afterword like Eve's to actually be the introduction. But in this book, the function of it is to open up a space for the reader to find their own way, and then further to be some containment, I suppose, provided by the afterword. And I suppose the reason why we have those various different strategies, structuring devices put in place is that the book is, I suppose it's set up to foster a self-reflective attitude in readers about sexuality, which historically has tended toward reification, including in psychoanalysis, and particularly in psychoanalysis as it appears in the clinic. And also the book is performative in style. So that means that the setup of the book creates the conditions it describes. So the book literally, as well as discursively, opens up a space for clinical readers to engage in an encounter with their own views on sexuality and how they might be bringing predetermined beliefs into the consulting room.
Okay. Can I interrupt you just a moment? You mentioned the reification of sexuality. Maybe you should explain what you're meaning when you say that before you go on with these different sections of the book.
Yeah, sure. I suppose when I talk about reification, I suppose there's a number of different ways we might think about that. I suppose psychoanalytic term concretization would be relevant here in terms of thoughts being present about sexuality. Thoughts are usually, when they're reified, they're usually picked up from books that people have read or from clinicians who have taught them or analysts or supervisors. And then they're reproduced without thinking them through. So the thoughts are present, but not the thinking apparatus to actually facilitate it being wondered about. So when something is reified, I would think that there is a sense in which people Yeah, people reproduce what they have heard and read rather than being able to wonder about it for themselves.
Especially with something like sexuality, which is so charged. There's probably a temptation to quickly get a handle on it and close things down with that process of reification. So yeah, clearly this book is working against that.
And describing there, I think is a way of describing the process in which people make assumptions and hold biases that are unquestioned. These givens that people approach, particularly the field of sexuality, which we've identified as one that is particularly prone to reification. People have ideas in a way, as opposed to, thinking these things through. And that is the aim of the book, is to shake those up for psychoanalysts and for those who work in the area of sexuality studies and gender studies and those who are interested in those areas.
Yes. Okay. So do you want to go on, Noreen, with specifically the three different sections, sort of how they work?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so there are three sections in the book. Section one features six chapters on key themes in queer theory by academic theorists of sexuality, and they work mainly in the arts and humanities. And we gave them each a theme, so identity, desire, pleasure, perversion, ethics, and discourse. So each of them were given a theme, and we asked them to write about those topics from the perspective of queer theory, but keeping in mind how queer theory in the instance of identity, for example, has been influenced by psychoanalysis, to write something about that. We didn't direct them to write about any particular tradition of psychoanalysis. And we asked them as well to keep in mind an audience of psychoanalytic clinicians who may not be familiar with queer theory. And then we left them to it. Then we collected all of those chapters, and we invited a number of clinical responses to them. So section two then includes 14 of those clinical responses written by 16 clinicians. A couple of the chapters are co-written. And these are by practicing psychoanalysts and psychoanalytic psychotherapists from different traditions who work with adults and or children and adolescents. And we asked them to read the chapters by the queer theorists and to respond to them and think about whether, not if, but whether those chapters might be useful for clinical practice or clinical thinking. And then they were left to write whatever they needed to write there. And then we collected all of those and we invited a number of people who are very familiar with both queer theory and psychoanalysis. And those responses are much briefer. We asked people to comment on the encounters as they encountered them themselves. And so section three features seven short commentaries of about 1,500 words on the nature of the encounters enacted by the book. By some of them are clinicians, some of them are theorists, but they're both familiar. They're familiar with both discourses. And in addition to that, we also invited a psychoanalytic practitioner who is also an art theorist to write about the encounter with the cover of the book, because that's the first encounter that the reader has. So I suppose the way the book is set up, just more generally about the idea of the sections, is that it's set up that the reader has a number of encounters with a number of different discourses, that none of the authors of the chapters got to see one another's responses to their chapters, and so that everybody saw the final piece, if you like, when it was published.
I particularly like those short ones at the end. Those were just really fun. In fact, sort of my response to this whole book, and anticipating this interview, I keep finding myself kind of smiling. The book was fun, at least at times. There are some kind of chapters that get into a kind of academic discourse that I wasn't completely able to follow, but then the next chapter would be completely sort of accessible to me. And so I think it's going to depend on where people are in being exposed to some of these kinds of writing and thinking. But I think there's something for everyone in it, even if they're very new to it. Do you guys have?
Yeah,
that's really good to hear, Philip. Our aim was to facilitate the creation of something that people could come at whatever level they're at. People do not have to be very well versed in queer theory, I think, to approach the book. They don't necessarily have to be a psychoanalytic practitioner. And interest in these areas is a more than sufficient place from which to start. And certainly, as I say, it's good to hear about the question of fun. That's not to belie, I think, the seriousness of the project. But in our world today, for example, politically, we think of certain leaders in our Western world who don't laugh and don't have any fun, for example, and this worries us. a mode of interrogation, isn't it? The ability to approach something and something is asked of us that we may not be quite sure of, and sometimes that response is a chuckle or a peal of laughter.
And I appreciate your reference to the seriousness too, because I don't know, I'm thinking myself, if I'd gone into analysis maybe 25 or 30 years earlier, I would have had a very different experience with psychoanalysis in terms of them wanting to cure me or pathologizing me. And so just remembering that when people come to us as practitioners, clinicians, and bringing us their most sort of intimate parts of their lives and delicate and how we're going to handle their sexuality can be so life-giving and even fun, or it can be tremendously hurtful, as psychoanalysis has been to people in the past. So that's my little editorializing. But let's get into this question, what is queer theory? I was at a party recently talking to a hedge fund guy, and I said, oh, I'm reading this book on psychoanalysis and queer theory. And he said, what's queer theory? And I had to sort of stop and, you know, fumble around a little bit. I did get somewhere with that, with an answer. But how would you two answer that?
Well, I suppose queer theory, one of the things about queer theory is it's very well known for resisting attempts at definition. And resistance is, I suppose, one of its major major identifiers, perhaps. Nevertheless, having said that, it's the words queer theory describe a number of different approaches to looking at sexuality, particularly sexual norms, sexual identities, pleasures, desires. Queer theory is, while it's an academic discourse and it can often be very difficult, I suppose, to engage with if you're not familiar with the discourse itself. Although it is an academic discourse and has attained some respectability in the academy, although there's always resistance to it, it's also a form of activism and came from activist, really developed out of activist resistances. Groups like Queer Nation, Outrage, the Lesbian Avengers, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power ACT UP, and their attempts to, I suppose, get to unleash some of the rage or the anger that was being felt by people being ignored during the AIDS crisis and when people were being gay-bashed and people were not being held responsible for that. So I suppose queer theory is a highly politicized discourse, saying that, and it's very concerned with looking at biased attitudes relating to sexuality, where certain acts, identities, pleasures and desires are seen as more socially acceptable or normal or natural or moral, particularly where heterosexuality or so-called opposite sex desires would be seen as more acceptable. So it's very much about unpicking those attitudes that are being presented as if they are the way, the attitudes that are being presented as if they are just the way it is. But while they're being presented as if they are just the way it is, they're actually putting forward unspoken motives that are generally about saying that certain people are good and other people are bad. I suppose queer theory engages very much with attempts to set up a charmed circle or a hierarchy of sexual identities, acts, desires, where certain sex acts or certain identities are seen again as being morally repugnant or morally acceptable, while others are not. So normativity, I suppose there would be four terms that I would see queer theory as engaging mostly with: identity, you know, trying to help people to reflect on why they identify in the way that they do. Normativity, as I was saying, these kind of latent normative attitudes or morally biased attitudes, and unpicking them in the manifest content of material. Relationality, how we relate to ourselves and others, and also discourse, the fact that words actually do have a performative power and can impact on the lives of people in horrible ways.
Yeah, and those are four things which are so important to the whole work of psychoanalysis. I'm trying to like go through them again. What were the four again?
Identity, yeah. Normativity, relationality, uh-huh. And discourse.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, I think people can begin to see how we're in a realm of things that psychoanalysis deals with. But so that's a sense of why people in the psychoanalytic world, what we might gain from learning more about queer theory. And after reading this book, of course, it becomes, I see how it's not just an accidental, sort of a luxury. It's sort of a necessity, I think, nowadays to, for people in the psychoanalytic world to be very familiar with the challenging questions that queer theory raises. What would you say to somebody who's on the other side of the table, who might be very steeped in culture studies, queer theory, is psychoanalysis relevant to them nowadays?
Well, Philip, would say that what the book attempts to do would be several things, such as to locate psychoanalysis, I think, in the 21st century, and to reflect on what I think we can describe as new sexual realities. I'm thinking of Danny Nobis's chapter in particular, where he talks about the importance of psychoanalysis of keeping up to date with developments in the field of sexuality. Certainly there's work to be done for psychoanalysis to keep up to date with the ever-changing and expanding 21st century sexual lexicon. And it has been accused of being out of step with contemporary sexuality, with its ideas about the Oedipus complex, the Electra complex, the paternal metaphor perversion, the drives and homosexuality, and so on. So we wanted to allow for psychoanalysis to be relevant today. We think there's a good case to be made for that. And one of the things we wanted to highlight is that we'd be better off saying psychoanalyses rather than psychoanalysis, because not only are there different schools of psychoanalysis, quite a number of those are represented in the book, but the schools also in terms of the history of psychoanalysis and what I would describe as the troubled history between psychoanalysis and homosexuality. Not all psychoanalytic schools approached this in the same way. And so I think what the book does is it draws out the distinction between, for example, institutionalized psychoanalysis and certain schools of thought that may, and indeed did, treat homosexuality with very problematic normalizing approaches. So what the book does is, and I think this is important, is it acknowledges this troubled history. It says it, it acknowledges it, and I think this tension is evident in the book. This tension that is there as a result of, and I think it has to do with I mean, if we think about the history of psychoanalysis, particularly after World War II, after the death of Freud, and the tide of emigration to the West, mainly to the Americas and the UK, psychoanalysts became preoccupied with fitting in to their new domiciles, and there ensued an effort to domesticate, some would say to domesticate the unconscious, but certainly the field of the sexual, particularly by new forms of psychoanalysis like ego psychology, which became prominent in the psychoanalytic institutions. And these approaches judged homosexuality to be non-normal, and they effectively deviated from Freud's principles, and gay and lesbian Annalise Anne's suffered from reprobate practices which deemed them perverse or psychotic on the basis of their sexual orientation. And so, for example, Ona Nierenberg's chapter in the book takes steps to acknowledge this history, but also to propose that there is a haunting that has occurred in the field of queer theory as a result of an unfinished mourning process, for example, around this deeply troubling history. So, with this acknowledgement, it is hoped that the discursive encounters will be, you know, more open between the two discourses, and certainly I hope the book suggests and offers for those working in the field of cultural studies and social studies a chance to think about psychoanalysis a little bit differently.
I think also just what Eve was saying there, just in as regards, you know, queer theory or cultural studies more broadly, that one of the things that has come out of the book, which you've probably seen yourself, Philip, is that the queer theory chapters tend to draw on one tradition of psychoanalysis above all others, which is Lacanian psychoanalysis, coming from the work of Jacques Lacan and his various interlocutors. And the other, so psychoanalysis, so Lacanian psychoanalysis, because in the universities, Lacanian psychoanalysis tends to be what is taught, takes the place of psychoanalysis, more generally, you've referred to psychoanalyses. So I suppose one of the things that I think queer theorists or cultural studies critics can learn from this book is the fact that there are many different approaches to psychoanalysis. Even though people are aware of that, they tend to only draw on one. So it'll open up, I think, a space for people to go and read other traditions. But also, people tend in queer theory anyway to mostly read, and I mentioned in the introduction that I wrote, but they mostly read particular queer theorists, like people like Judith Butler, Eve Sedgwick, Tim Dean, Leo Bersani, Lee Edelman. There's quite a number of them who use psychoanalysis. And people tend to read their work and how they interpret Freud, Lacan, Klein, whoever it might be, rather than actually going back and reading the psychoanalyst for themselves. And I don't know whether it's because I was trained first as a historian, where you always go back and read the primary sources. The secondary sources I watch opens up the discourse for you, but you go back to the primary sources. But I think it's an invitation, the book, mm-hmm. for people to actually go back and pick up psychoanalysis from its actual source, and that while there are perhaps some problematic elements to it, sometimes they're magnified in critique because that's just the nature of writing, that people tend to have to stake out a position and to argue it. So I think it offers cultural studies critics that as well. And just in relation to that, Eve, you'll remember we did an event in the Freud Museum in London. Just one of the things that one of the speakers said, which has stayed with me, and I think is really interesting, is that Professor Lisa Breitzer from Birkbeck University of London, she said that she felt that the reason queer theory keeps on coming to psychoanalysis, even though it has a really ambivalent kind of love-hate relationship with psychoanalysis, is because queer theory doesn't actually have a theory of sexuality. And I think for me, having worked in queer theory, I would think queer theory is very much about resistance. And it's very useful for that, not allowing yourself to be subsumed by the other, but always trying to leave a space for thinking about yourself. But I think that idea of, I think that even just that queer theory doesn't have a theory of sexuality, I think that in itself will give queer theorists a lot to think about.
Yeah, that's an interesting statement.
And I would say, sorry, Philip, for interrupting you there. I would say also psychoanalysis doesn't have a theory of sexuality. There are theories of sexuality. But again, you know, if we go back to Freud, and we could go back, for example, to the three essays, that is not a comprehensive theory of sexuality. It's an account that we are continuing to pore over today to try and get a sense of the multifarious ways in which sexuality expresses itself in human subjectivity. It would seem that there should be good ground for psychoanalysis or psychoanalyses and queer theory to find some common ground and to be able to work together. And also to say that because the emphasis is here is on clinical psychoanalysis, we also hope that the clinical case study, which is the psychoanalytic tool par excellence, may be something of greater interest now to specialists in gender and sexuality as a mode of thinking about human sexuality in decentered terms, and particularly in non-binary and singular ways. And I suppose I'm thinking about Ken Corbett's chapter in particular about queer childhood and the wonderful case of Lincoln, which I think is an example of an analyst who doesn't judge his melancholy little protege and who must bear not knowing what the drawing is that Lincoln gives to him and insists it be placed under the shelter of his radiator in his consulting room, and allows for a reflective space to come into being that gives, I think, this child the mental freedom to express his confusion. And as Corbett says himself, he's able to do this because there is no summarizing originary explanation. No summarizing originary explanation. This is not the cause. This is not the reason. This is again what differentiates psychoanalysis and queer theory from in particular essentializing notions of sexuality. And this facilitates a kind of, as Corbett puts it, a recontextualizing of relations and phantasmatic spaces. So lots of potential there.
Yeah, I really was interested in that Corbett chapter because in the beginning I was struggling with it. But when he got to the clinical vignette, it was just really something lovely about that vignette that was really beautiful, I thought. And so since we're in this world of clinical vignettes and clinical psychoanalysis, I guess it's implied already in much of what's been said in this, the last, 38 minutes. Oh, wow. We're getting to the end. What would you, if I'm a clinician who's really been very exposed, very little to queer theory, let's say listening to this podcast, how do you think reading this book would change what I'm doing in the consulting room or impact it?
That's a great question, Philip. It's really a-
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking it sounds so simplistic in some ways.
Not at all. I think it's a wonderful question. And I think it's really important we try to say something about this. And I think Noreen, in a way, has already spoken to this in speaking about her experience, and I add to this my own experience of psychoanalytic clinicians who seem more closed than open to thinking about sexuality in non-reified ways, and that I suppose. In terms of what this book would offer psychoanalysis, those interested in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic practitioners, I suppose it's about, I suppose, keeping up to date and reading and thinking widely so that psychoanalysis doesn't become stale and outdated. Sometimes a perception that does exist, it is sometimes unfair, sometimes it's not unfair. To go back to the conference that Noreen mentioned there at the Freud Museum in February of this year, February 2018, that addressed itself to how social, cultural, and historical attitudes towards sexuality impact on the clinic, on transference, on countertransference. And it seemed to us that practitioners would benefit immensely from thinking about these, from thinking much more about this. There is the idea that the clinic exists in a kind of bubble, as if it is not somehow trans individual. It is trans individual. We live in a world where we are impacted, of course, by the social, the cultural, and the historical, and we are going to get into trouble if we don't think about what those impacts are. It is our hope that the book will cause practitioners to think about those impacts, to think about their relationship to those impacts in a reflective way.
I think just to follow on there from what Eva said, that, you know, what you were saying about like a practitioner who's kind of thinking whether, you know, there's so many books are published all the time and whether they should go and buy this one and whether they should spend the time reading it. I suppose maybe just in general terms that when we go into the consulting room to meet a patient, we try to open ourselves up for an encounter with the other. And that's a very easy thing to say, but I think as all of us know who work clinically, that is actually a very, very difficult thing to do, and to remain open to the other and the other's experience and to really sit with that. And I think that this experience of difference has profound and far-reaching effects for all of us as individuals and as a group of psychoanalytic practitioners, because I think the turbulence engendered in us as a result of sitting with uncertainty, with sitting with somebody who has a different subjectivity than our own, who is separate, that this leads, I think, us in different ways. I'm saying all, I'm making a generalization here, but all of us, it leads us to seek certainty in other aspects of our experience. And we can get stuck on certain ideas so that particular things, I think, become quite concrete and reified. So for some people, it may be sexuality. For other people, it may be something else. And I think that sexuality in particular can become a convenient depository for some of these concretized, unmetabolized, and also unthinkable thoughts, because I think it's such an intimate and difficult aspect of experience for most, if not all of us. And I think for a practitioner out there, it's not that they will gain some knowledge about LGBT experience or what it's like to work with people who are different than you. But I think what the book is actually about is how can you turn a mirror on yourself and actually look at what the assumptions that you have about sexuality because of your own experience or because of what you've been taught and have absorbed and identified with from others. So I think as a practitioner, if you're thinking about a book to read, I think that's the encounter that we're hoping that people will have. But then it's up to the reader whether they have it or not. The reader has to be willing to engage.
And how, I guess this has been out about a year or so, but can you say anything about how it's been received or how you two feel about a follow-up, or is it calling for something more?
Yeah. Well, just in terms of when you asked that there about a follow-up, I suppose what I think of when you say that is I think about film. I watch a lot of films and I teach a lot of film as well. And I think about sequels to films. And I think about how a sequel often comes out because it's almost like it's to plug up a gap that has been produced by a demand based on satisfaction, that if people enjoy the film and if it's making loads of money and all the rest, that they will go to produce something else. But as we know, I think from a lot of sequels, that satisfaction can very quickly turn to frustration, and that something that's deemed kind of good can become bad quite quickly. And I suppose the book, for me anyway, and I don't know what you'll think of this, Eve, but it's not an end point. It's very much about opening up a space for people to help them to reflect and to learn something about their own choices and their own desires and reactions. And I think that if it does open up a gap where people would like a sequel, well, I think then the book has done its work.
Yeah, so kind of like mission accomplished, and I think it does do that very much. And in fact, you two asked me via email to give if we could maybe end with my.
We have a question for you about that. Well, the question is, I mean, we would love you to say a little bit about. You know, your own experience of the book, and what, you know, whether you found anything in the book that is useful for your own work, and do you think it's of interest to people?
I really like books about psychoanalysis, obviously, that are structured as encounters or dialogues or compares and contrasts. So this bringing together of these two different discourses, psychoanalysis and queer theory, to me, for some reason, that works for me in terms of learning. I learned so much more about what psychoanalysis is from seeing it through the lens of queer theory and then vice versa. So that was one thing I really liked about the book. And in fact, there's another book I might do next, which is a similar encounter between what Kleinian and Winnicottian psychoanalysis, Bob Henschelwood and Eve or Jan Abram. They don't know that yet, but it's a similar kind of discussion. It was so fun to see Bob Henschelwood writing a chapter in your book, because I never would have placed him in a book on queer theory, but he did fantastic. So I like those. Yeah.
And he loved the discourse. He loved the challenge.
Yeah. So there's the coming together of those two things. But then I think what really began to open things up for me and challenge me is the two, I don't know if you call them faces of Freud, the original, maybe what we call the early, very revolutionary maybe we could even say queer Freud, that sort of shocked the world and disrupted how we thought about things and began to put this mystery of sexuality at the center of everything. And then the later, I think Eve calls it the institutionalized Freudian or the neo-Freudianism, which I think infiltrates so many of us in ways that we don't always know and recognize. And so I found myself really finding it very refreshing to see, I think Tim Dean's phrase that psychoanalysis is a queer theory is something he said. I think that was really very educational for me. So I really was also enjoyed meeting a lot of new authors and writers that I would like to go read more of some of their stuff too. So any last words from the two of you?
Well, I suppose I'd be interested to hear what you didn't like about the book.
Oh, what I didn't like. Well, you know, sometimes queer theory and culture studies can be so abstract, and there are occasional paragraphs or pages where I feel stupid and I'm not sure if it's me or if there's something I'm not far enough along yet, or if there really is maybe something about the writing that's gone off track. But there is a bit of that that I came across in the book. But every book probably has, you know, parts you don't, aren't your cup of tea, but that was my thought.
Thank you. I would say, just as a follow-up there, Philip, to your mentioning there of psychoanalysis being a queer theory, it can be. It hasn't always been. It should be. And hopefully it will be of interest to people in that sense. And we appreciate so much your invitation to speak to you today about the book that has preoccupied us for the last 8 years, and that we are pleased to talk about today with you.
Well, I think that's a great way to end with that line that psychoanalysis isn't always a queer theory, but it should be. I think that's definitely a provocative sort of proposition that may cause some people to want to open up this book. So thank you so very much. You've been listening to an interview with Noreen Giffney and Eve Watson about their book, Clinical Encounters in Sexuality, Psychoanalytic Practice and Queer Theory, here at the New Books Network. Check out our website and feel free to email me with your comments and questions. Thanks for listening.